Welcome to Let's Talk, brought to you live by the National Indigenous Radio Service, the only opportunity offered to the broader community to be informed on the issues and current affairs from a First Nations perspective. This is Bo Spearham with Let's Talk.
Good morning and welcome to Let's Talk. Before I go on any further, I would like to acknowledge the traditional owners on this land we are broadcasting from. I also would like to pay my respects to our elders and also our elders of more recent arrival. And a good morning to everybody around the continent that is taking our show via the National Indigenous Radio Service, NIRS. Also listening via our app, 989FM app, which you can get from app stores. And also our website, 989fm.com.au. Streaming us around the globe and also around the continent. Thank you for joining us from wherever you are this morning or whatever time it is you're tuning in. This morning I'll be playing part two of Challenging the Racist Castral System, a panel discussion chaired by Nettery Mabo. This will be part two. Yesterday I played part one, and on Monday I played Why Abolition for First Nations Women, and that was chaired by Melissa Lukashenko. So this is continuing on from me being allowed and also having access to record, being very privileged to record the 9th Sisters Inside International Conference, Imagining Abolition, A World Without Prisons. First Nations women and non-Indigenous peoples attended the conference and also spoke at the conference from all over the globe, which was really, really deadly and powerful to see. On Friday, actually, we hosted a dinner with some of the speakers and also some of the mob that just went to the conference. It was really good, really good success. Raised a bit of money for the Murray Christmas party and also for Sisters Inside. But yeah, you know, we're going to play this panel, Challenging the Racist Castral System, Part 2. And this is chaired by Nettery Mabo from Sisters Inside, who runs a youth program.
These guys don't need an introduction.
Ete puere amo ko puna Ita uri uri ita wānu I tangata Nei ra e kākano Whakatonga, whakatonga, whakatonga.
Tēnā koutou katoa ke te mihi tuatahi. E ngā tangata ko huri ki te pō. Moi mai haere atura. Moi mai ki te Hawaiki nui, ki te Hawaiki roa ki te Hawaiki pau māmau. Mauri ora ki a koutou, moi mai rā. Ka huri ngā mihi ki ngā tangata ora. Kei te mihi e ngā tangata o te rohi nei, o te motu nei. Mauri ora ki a koutou, koa whakatau mai rā nei ki a tātou i tēnei wā ki a mātou no Aotearoa, New Zealand. Tēnā koutou katoa e ngā tangata. Kei te mihi nui ki a koe te rangatira, Debbie. Ko karanga mai rā ki a mātou, tēnā koutou ki a tātou, tēnā koutou katoa. Kia ora, everyone. It's a privilege always to walk on the whenua and the land of others and to be welcomed on. And so on behalf of our wahine from wahine Māori from Aotearoa, New Zealand, to be welcomed here, ngā mihi nui ki a koutou, ki a koe whaia, Sandy, tēnā koutou. And to say that the struggles and the stories are shared for our whānau as Māori and as Indigenous people from this land, that coming from colonised nations, what does that look like in terms of the incarceration of our people? And that's just one tool that's used to perpetuate the shoulders of which colonisers can stand on
is to keep us colonised and to keep these stories, to keep us in our negative reality that has been imposed upon us. So I just want to acknowledge that the mamai, the hurt and the stories and the incarceration of our people are our families, are our children, are our mothers, are our nanas, are our brothers, are our sisters, are our daughters, are our mokopuna, are our grandkids. Those are us. They... And so the mamai and the struggles that is happening here for us back home, those are the struggles that, that we fight also, to acknowledge the experiences and reality of what it looks like to be walking in this world as our ancestors, and in the hopes and aspirations that we can never let go of for our grandchildren. And to acknowledge the Indigenous people here, you are our tōkana, you are our elders. You are our elders, and so thank you for letting us be here. I just want to say I want to speak for a short time, but want to say one of the things that I think as an Indigenous person, as Māori at home, and I think that can be shared here, by dint of being Indigenous in a colonised country means we are affected by an injustice system. So when we talk about the challenges of a racist carceral system, the challenge is actually in our visibility and in our strength. It is in the inspiration of seeing our young people present their art and do and present themselves and express themselves in the way that they want to. It's in the inspiration of last night and seeing the positive stories that happen, because those are the challenges where we can just be, and we can just be an expression of ourselves, because we stand on the shoulders of giants. We come from our ancestors who are the one thing that remains true forevermore. It's not the fact that our people are locked up by a racist colonised system. It is the fact of the depth of rangatiratanga, of the mana. It is the what runs in our bloodlines, and it is in the kaitiakitanga and the caring of our whānau and who we are and who we can be to exist. So the challenge is just being, and the challenge is creating these spaces where we can come together and accept as fact that we have a colonised system, and that looks like a racist prison system, that looks like a racist state, not a care system, because they certainly don't care for our children when the state comes and steals. I call them whakapapa stealers, which means... something like that. But that's for our young ones in this room, or for everyone in this room, but for our rangatahi and our young people, who you are and who is in your blood, whatever is happening and what you know about your reality and what the outside world keeps giving you messages that you're meant to be in prison, you're meant to be whatever. Those are not the truths. Those are their truths that they need to believe so that they can stand tall. But that is not who you are. And my aspiration and dream, as it is for all of us, is that everyone has the right to live our full potential and to be able to do that. And so it's inspiration for me to see our young ones last night doing the do, and for the shoulders that are walking to allow you to do that. So that's the challenges that we present. It's by being in these hui's, wearing our no racism shirts. It's when Deb goes into court, goes into the prisons and uses the tools of the colonizer to make sure that it doesn't harm our people anymore. Everywhere is a challenge. Every day we breathe is a challenge, and every day we can smile and just be. Those are the challenges. But hoi anō, I want to mihi to you, Deb, because when you create a platform where the voices of those who are often spoken about, our incarcerated family, our incarcerated whānau and people who have that lived experience, I acknowledge you all in this room. And Deb, your words that you can never be free unless all your sisters are free. And for everyone, if you're in this work, none of us can be free until all our whānau are free. So kei te mihi, and on that I want to pass this to my tōkana, Tricia Walsh, because from home, from the coast... Oh, for those of you not from New Zealand, the coast only means the East Coast, Ngāti Porou. But obvs. But she can share the voice of her experience and what that looks like. And thank you for having me here. Tēnā koutou katoa.
Oh, I'm a little bit nervous. Firstly, I'd like to acknowledge the ancestors or the tangata whenua of these lands that weren't ceded, that were stolen. Yeah, thank you for allowing me to stand, connect with your earth and bring to you a koha or a gift of my experiences of the justice system and lived experience of life. I've just had a tooth pulled out and my plate that I'm wearing that is this front tooth, it now has nothing to anchor it in my mouth. So if this plate falls out, please don't take photos of me with my tooth missing. So to start this, I'd like to give a trigger warning, and for the young children and babies that are in this room, that what I'm about to share, it might not be for the ears, but it's my journey, my story of my life, of how I got to be here in this room with you. So, yeah, like I said, my name is Tricia Walsh. My claim to fame is I have 13 mokopuna, 13 grandchildren, 8 girls and 5 boys. 4 and 1 is in, and he's just deciding how great he's going to be and how handsome he's going to be, so I haven't met him yet. In another world I have. And I kind of want to say that I never considered myself as a black woman before, and I never considered myself to be a woman of colour. So those are new things that have kind of given... It hurts. It hurts because that... it really draws a line between white and people like me, like us. So that's the way I'll think of myself and my mokos and that now. So my last, much like Vicky, my last prison sentence ended in 2010 and I had 2.5 years on parole from that 2010. I have 144 convictions. I've been to prison 5 times in my life. And the years accumulate to 20 plus. And I was guilty of it all. I was guilty, I did it. I sold marijuana to sustain a lifestyle for my kids. Solo mum, I'm a solo nanny. So when I got out of, my prison journey started when I was 16, but I was already in the system before that. At the age of 16, with a 6-month-old baby, I got corrective training, it's called in New Zealand, which was a 3-month army-style sentence. And yeah, it was meant to punish me enough to open my eyes. I don't know what it was for, but it didn't work. Well, it didn't put food on the table and it didn't change the way that I felt about myself and it didn't change the way about how I positioned myself within the world. And, you know, so when I got out in 2010, I was 44 years old. My first grandson, he was 4 years old. My kids had left home, so I came out. I mean, I'd been a mother since I was 15 and I came out to nothing because my kids didn't need me anymore. They were all adults and I thought, you know, who was Tricia Walsh if she wasn't a mum? And it really was confronting and, you know, before I went to prison, I had a raging crack habit. I don't know what you fellas call it here, but on meth, I was, you know, 39 kilos. I was pretty out the gates. So when I got out again, I kind of got back into the crack scene. And, you know, when my son got, him and his partner got pregnant again, the one with the four-year-old, he sort of said to me, you know, Mum, you need to stop what you're doing or you will not be a part of my kid's life. And I thought, ooh. You know, but then he also gave me a koha. He told me that I was the strongest person that he'd ever met and that I could do anything. And at no stage in my 44 years, this may have been closer to 45, did I ever think that I was strong enough, that I had choices, that I could be anything different than what I'd been, what I had been trained to be my whole life. And I thought, wow, you know, that's amazing, the love of a son. Hey, the love for his family, but that he loved me that much. Hey, and I thought, wow, okay, so I'm here. How do I do that? How do I be that person that my four adult kids could be proud of? That wasn't a jailbird, drug dealer, crackhead, that didn't have a place to stay, that was sleeping from couch to couch. How do I change who I'd been for 44 years? You know, so I thought, well, first I've got to figure out, how did I get here? How did I get there? Okay? So I had to be pretty brave and I had to start looking back over my life. And I realised that there probably was no other way that I could have ended up. My dad started sexually abusing me at 15 months old. My mum used to beat me, kick me, put my head through windows. You know, that's the life I had from a four-year-old. I remember those hidings from my mum every day. And if my dad wasn't in jail, my dad was abusing me. And because our house was a party house, you fellas seen Once Were Warriors? Once Were Warriors had nothing on my house. So because our house was a party house and my mum was so drunk, she didn't know who was coming in and out of my bedroom, I had 50 different abusers by the age of 12. 50 different whānau members. They weren't Freddy Krueger or strangers. They were my whānau. They were my mum's friends. They were cousins. They were her boyfriends. All of them took something from me. All of them took something from that little girl that she couldn't put back together again. They were taking and taking, and my mum was beating and beating me. I didn't have a chance to connect with the waidu or the spirit that we need to know, we need to be intimately aware of so that we can grow up to be so-called normal members of our societies. Hey, normal members of your skin group. Normal members of our hapu. But nobody saw that. All they saw was the anger, was the sulkiness, was the sadness. And I had to sulk because I knew that everybody that came into that house, I wasn't safe. Everybody that came in that house, I was the target because they knew my mother didn't love me. I was that unlovable kid that everyone saw. If you're a child molester or you're a pedophile, you pick out the kid that's not loved, eh? You pick out the kid that everyone picks on, and that was me, okay? 12 years old, I tried to, my first attempt at taking my life. I couldn't stand it anymore. I didn't know where I stopped or where I began, and people kept taking. But I'd learned by then that I deserved it. I must have deserved it. I must have did it. I must have did something to deserve having my head smashed into the floor. I must have did something for them to pull my leg from under my bed because that's where I went to feel safe at night. Or in the wardrobe, but they still found me. 13 years old, I dropped out of school, onto the streets, joined with the gangs, their sexual abuse continued, but I was getting beaten up by then, the same way I watched my dad beat my mum up. My dad used to stab my mum up, used to attack her with axes. So when it started happening to me, it was normal. That's what happens when you love somebody. That's how they show that they love you. I must have deserved the hiding. I shouldn't have answered back. When I was 13, 14, I didn't know any different. And then you go through the ringer of gang men and you watch the treatment of the girls, the way they treat women. And you believe that that's what it is like to be Māori, to be a woman. My mum once told me when I went crying to her after one of the beatings that I made my bed. Now I had to lie in it. So, you know, with the abuse, with the violence, with the broken relationships, I became addicted to everything that there was out there. Started sniffing, then it was weed for a little while, and then the doctor started prescribing me barbiturates. All the PAMs, those were all my friends. All the PAMs. Temazepam, clonazepam, diazepam. Whoa, you name it, those are my friends. But then when things got tough, I would down a few bottles of those too and stomach pumped, and all the while I'd become a mum at 15 and had three kids at 19. So this was the kind of mother that my kids were raised by. Their dad used to beat me all the time. So, you know, there would be a month would go by when I couldn't walk. I couldn't get out of bed. My kids would look after me though. You know, that was their mother. I was meant to be looking after them, but they were looking after me. And their father was in and out of jail. And then once I started getting right into selling weed, and I wasn't a very good criminal either because I always got caught. But over the years, you know, things didn't get better. I kept doing the same dumb stuff. I'd go to jail, come out, and for a week I'd try to, or a bit longer, but I'd try to raise my kids on a benefit and realise that, you know, I thought that they deserved more. So I would go back to selling weed, back living the lifestyle, back worrying about who was behind me and who was listening to me on the phone and whose was that drone. And, you know, I was... But I raised my kids in that environment. And we all know about intergenerational trauma, intergenerational prison, incarceration. So I taught my kids that this was normal, that was life. When they dropped out of school, I thought it was normal. When they started getting into trouble, normal. I didn't want them to, but it was no big deal because I did too. How much longer?
5 minutes.
2 minutes. But it was normal. So I didn't even have aspirations for my kids other than the life we had. I didn't think that anything could be different. So we just rolled on, rocked on. We were famous for being fighters and no one would F around with us. And, you know, I was proud of me and my kids. I thought we had reached the pinnacle of fame. but I never, in all those years, I never loved me. I didn't know what it was like to love me, and I was always looking outside of myself for something that would make me feel better, because I didn't believe, I'd been taught that I was rubbish from a very young age, that I was rubbish. And I looked for all of those things outside of myself to make me feel better. And I never realised that there were choices, because I never saw them. What I did was my only choice. I thought that people that had jobs, they were a special kind of breed. And people that owned cars, you know, that had houses and had diplomas and went to school, they were special. That wasn't for someone like me. That's what I thought. And it, sadly, as much as I wanted my kids to be like that, I didn't know how to get them there. But I knew how to. I knew how to teach them how to fight. I knew how to teach them how to turn $3,000 into $6,000, because that's what I was good at. And sadly, that's what I taught my kids. So when that last jail term came along, I got 9.5 years, was possession of LSD, 5.5 years for 2.5 kilos of weed. But I'm a recidivist offender, so the next time I get caught with weed, I've been told it'll be life, so nobody slip anything into my bag, okay? I want to go home. You know, at that time, my daughter was 13. The years when, you know, she most needed her mum, and when I did that lag, it was like, you know, you count every second of every minute of every hour of every day. You count them. And you miss. And I didn't know if what had happened to me was happening to her and who was looking after her. But I'd given up that right. I'd given up that right when I continued to sell marijuana. I'd given up the right of a mother. But it hurt, and I cried. But I only cried when people couldn't see me, because I've never been allowed to cry. You know, shut your mouth, I'll give you something to cry for, and they're stomping your head until you're... But hey... So when I got out, my two girls were in extremely violent relationships, being stabbed, being beaten. I taught them really well. Hey, they were good learners. Hey, role modelling. My boy ran away here to Sydney because he didn't want to be known as part of our family anymore. He didn't want to be known as my son. So how? Hey. How was I going to do things differently? That was a challenge. But I had to go back and okay, those things happened to me, okay? I've got eight granddaughters. So I knew that I needed to give them a different life if things were going to be different for them. And I'm a solo nanny. Hey, solo mum, solo nanny. So I made some decisions. I went back, you know, I got a horrific record. I got told I couldn't, I wasn't allowed to study. I signed up for Bachelor of Social Work, and they do a criminal check, and it was like they said that they opened the envelope and this thing went... One of them said that they said, oh my God, is it going to stop? So they declined my application, and I'd already told my kids, I'm going to be a social worker. And they were like, Mom, too much. They were so proud of me, and I was like, oh yeah, I'm going to be a social worker. And these people sent me this letter, oh hell no. No, and I thought, I told my kids, they were proud of me for once in their life. I thought, I've got to go in there and change their minds, because I can't tell my kids, it would have been another lie, another lie that I'd told them in their lifetime. So I marched to the wānanga, we call it, and I got a meeting with a board, and I said to them, they said, well, you know, this is pretty out there. We've never had someone like this. And I said, yeah, but I'm not that person anymore. Hey. I've got hopes and I've got dreams. And they... I'm over here now. And I've got plans for my mokopuna's future that are miles away from that and that person who was hurt and broken and damaged and was trying to put herself back together again and didn't know how. And nobody could tell me how either, because I was good at keeping secrets. I was good, at hiding all that pain and shame, but I couldn't hide the anger. So they let me do that course. And at the end of it, I graduated as valedictorian. Moved on and started my master's, but I've sort of come to a boop, boop. But, you know, I'm proud of who I am. I'm a survivor. But now I want to live my life. And I want to live my life creating a space where my mokopuna, our mokos, where they can be safe. Because that's all I want is safety. I never had safety. You know, when they come to me and I look at the different ages in their life and I think at that age this was happening to me, at that age, but I know it's not happening to them. And that is my kaitiaki responsibility. That is what I need to do. But I didn't know that I had that power, that the mana to do that was in here all along, because people hid it from me when I was a child and I hid it from myself with the drugs when I was an adult. But to make the change, you got to be the change. Yeah. Hey. Yeah. Yeah. So I'm all good. My kids are, man, they're fabulous. One of my sons is Mr. New Zealand in the bodybuilding. My other son is Mr. East Coast in the bodybuilding. And my girl's going to be a nurse and she's just waiting for your states. And then my big girl, she's a lollipop girl. But I'm proud of them. You know, we're working really hard to get that imprisonment and that court and all those systems to keep them out of our lives, because they don't belong there. Hey, they don't belong there. Oh. So thank you for listening to me. Kia ora.
Kia ora tui hui mai tātou, kia ora koutou katoa, nā mihi aroha, kia koutou. Ko wai au, ko maunga pohatu, te maunga, ko orua kaurau, te awa, ko mā tātua, te waka, ko otanuku, te marae, ko tūhoi, te iwi, ko Tracy McIntosh ahau. Tēnā koutou, tēnā koutou, tēnā koutou katoa. Kia ora, Trish. Kia ora, Trisha. What an astonishing... Yeah, there's so many stories when we're talking about what could be said and talk about the notions around dispossession. She's able to trace the whakapapa, her descent lines, at least five generations back, where we see where the dispossession created the change in her whānau. But staying in that whānau space as you have today, Trisha, obviously the Ātua knew and resonated with that story that you told. I just want to recognise the land that we stand on, the unceded sovereign spaces. I want to recognise the elders, past, present, and to those generational seeds that live within us and that will go forward. When I come to these places, I come with my ancestors, but I also come with my mokopuna, my grandchildren. And I'm just, the only way I can get into my computer is actually writing all my grandchildren's names. It's an interesting sort of thing. It's not the fastest thing you do, but it's an interesting thing to do. I'm going to speak very, very shortly. I know that what you're really, really wanting is a whole lot of political economy, sociological deep analysis. I know you're really saying, please, please, let's have some more of that. But we've got people far better than me that can do that, and I just want to mihi out to those that have come with me. Certainly I look to our rangatahi, our young people, Julia, and all those from Papa that sit there. Our wonderful direct action abolitionists from Aotearoa, New Zealand. They are my children, they are my students, but mostly they are my teachers. And I want to recognise that. They always put themselves in harm's way. I don't want them in harm's way. I'm always trying to tell them to put themselves in the harm's way, that there's a whole range of ways we can do the revolution. But I recognise the role that they play, and as I say, that I learn from them all of the time. Julia and others take us to places that I can hardly imagine, and it gives me great hope and confidence for our future. For Trish, to draw on that experience, to recognise your expertise, that you're an expert of your own condition, and that your stories, your pūrākau, will create the changes, not only for your whānau, but for those who listen, for those who hear, and for those that come. So to imagine then is to draw on these creative, intellectual, emotional, cultural, and spiritual energies to create a just society where social harm is diminished, where community safety is enhanced, where victims and perpetrators are not constantly reproduced, is within our power. For those not in this room, the carceral logic we live with creates this cognitive restriction. It expresses their ability to think beyond the prison, or think that there is a beyond the prison. So when I think about the work of Gina, when I think about the work of Angela, when I think about the mahi, the constant work of Debbie and all others, this is the foundations. These are the po for our hope. We have it also in Aotearoa, New Zealand. We think of people like Moana Jackson. We think of people like Ane Makaere, those that have also set the things, and our ancestors well before. An abolitionist ethic identifies the dehumanisation, violence, and racial degradation of incarceration and punitive policing. is the basic structure and dynamic of penal practice. It recognises that maintaining social order through incarceration emerges as a way to preserve the power relations inherent in slavery in some places and invader colonisation in others. Abolition decidedly does not seek to replace incarceration with alternatives that are closely related to imprisonment, such as punitive policing, non-custodial criminal supervision, probation, or community forms of institutionalisation and parole. An abolitionist framework requires positive forms of social integration, collective security that are not organised around criminal law enforcement, not around confinement, not around criminal surveillance, not around any forms of those types of punishments. The structural reform measures focus instead on expanding the space in which people are safe from harm, including interpersonal and intimate forms of harm and collective harm, and are able to forge relationships of greater inequality. We hear about relationships because they are the lifeblood. They're the lifeblood for Indigenous people, but they are the lifeblood for us as people. It is the gift of indigeneity that we give to everyone. It is around the absolute, the way that that all of our relationships are our lifeblood. And I've got a whole lot there. I'm going to move through that as much as I know you're really hanging out for it. I mean, I think that is one of the things that, and Debbie talked about it last night, we need to be clear that our problem would not be addressed if we just closed the prisons tomorrow and did nothing more. If prison abolition is conceptualised solely as just opening of the prison doors, that is the physical, the imminent physical elimination of all structures of incarceration, perhaps rejection of abolition would be warranted. But abolition must be understood instead as this project of decarceration in which we draw on radically different legal, social and institutional regulatory forms to replace criminal law enforcement. In New Zealand, it would mean the ceding of penal power and the resourcing of iwi, that is tribes and community. It certainly, as I said, does not mean that we replicate our current prison situation. At the moment, Julia and I are on this reviewing. We're an independent group sitting under a ministerial government inquiry looking at our entire justice system to create a new project of thinking about justice. And we've been travelling as part of this Te Uepu Hapai Te Ora about safe and effective justice throughout our country, and we've heard clearly in those communities that the possibility of a just society sit within communities and sit within those that develop strong relationships. And it is absolutely around power and the devolving of that power into communities, into those places. I've got a whole lot of things about drug reform and in urban and rural development and greening and proliferating restorative forms of redress and et cetera, et cetera. Certainly, and I'm going to leave it to others who do it better than me along these lines, we need to absolutely address the forms of structural violence. It means addressing the legacies of racism and colonialism and the need for a radical honesty in discussing and responding to these devastating legacies. It means significant cultural change about how we discuss social harm and responses to social harm. It means a new language. It means new forms of media engagement, new forms of the way that we talk about social harms, new ways of responding to it. When abolition is conceptualised in these terms as a transformative goal of decarceration and the substitution of positive social regulations where penal regulation is recognised as morally, socially, culturally, economically unsustainable. So for this to happen, it must first be an act of imagination informed by those who have lived experience of the conditions of incarceration, informed by research by allied researchers who recognise that those who have been incarcerated are experts of their own condition, informed by the experience of those who have been harmed and caused harm, and a recognition that too often these are not discrete or separate groups. It must be fueled for a desire for greater levels of safety and reduction of social harm. It must be focused on ensuring better lives for all of our mokopuna, our grandchildren and their mokopuna. And I really recognise the grandmothers in this room. I'm a nanny myself. I have 7 children, 3 and 3 grandchildren. But what I'm going to finish with is something about who I really represent and why I stand there and others don't stand there. So I represent those who cannot be here. I represent those young women who are incarcerated right now, who at the moment are in a lock. They'll be, they'll be locked through right and through till dinner, which they'll be served in their cell. So I'm going to draw on their work, which they bring to you as I bring to you as their gift to you, their koha to you, their taonga to you, their treasure to you. And, you know, Chelsea brought us Maya Angelou's Caged Bird poem this morning. And in reading this, that one, I recognise that one of the young women responded, when she first heard that poem, she's responded. I might do that one last because I actually see it very much as an abolition poem. So I'll start three poems. The first one is Misery So Pure, and I do want to show that so we get the sense of this young woman in our space. I always bring all the poems with me wherever I go. I travel with them all the time, so I absolutely stay grounded in what my work is and who I really speak for. So this one is called Misery So Pure, and there was something that was said this morning that really captured something that was in here. Broken hearts fear the loudest, a prisoner's tears fall the hardest. Broken bones can always heal, but words seep in and remain painful to feel. Trapped souls struggle in the arms of hell, but in the cell the walls never tell. Broken dreams reveal a forgotten call, yet a scream doesn't seem to be heard at all. Surrendered in the heart of hate, the devil inside never turns up late. Broken roads lead to a complete end, a prisoner's journey is always around the bend. Living life only to die inside the broken and tainted heart I hide. The worst thing in life that you never see is being captured, having never been free. The deepest and the darkest places to be, waiting for the system to release me, killing all innocence and hope, but not the pain or the mess devastation caused. With me to blame, no one to love and no one to hear, the passion and the addiction to fear, a waiting for life to begin and start. This was the journey of my heart. And you'll see that last line is something that refrains. The young woman who wrote this was arrested at 14, convicted of a life sentence at 15, and has been in 11 years and has not yet had her first parole. When we start a speech in Māori, or when we end a speech in Māori, or before we start, we often say the tihe Māori ora, hark the breath of life. You see, when we hongi, we also share that breath of life. And so it's a really sort of important element within Māori culture. And so this particular poem, the second line of it, when I first heard it, the way that I reacted and thinking about how this sits in our cultural spaces. Maybe chances were never chanced and life never breathed me. Maybe everyone gave up on me and the devil came and claimed me. Maybe failure was inevitable and the inevitable never failed me. Maybe love hated me and hate really loved me. Maybe family were associates and associates were my family. Maybe the dark seemed to bring me light and the light brought me under. Maybe captivity captured me and my life really eluded me. Maybe I can't give up as that means I'm letting the system win. Maybe time and time again I fail and fail time and time again. Maybe chances were never chanced and life never breathed me. And the last one then is responding to the very first time that she read, and it's probably about 3 years ago. This is someone who was out of the compulsory education system by 12, had been, and by the time she was 12, maybe to 10 schools, had been in and out of state care, that there were so many spaces, there were so many places that we could have intervened. And here I talk about indigenous intervention, possibly about state interventions around these moral and cultural obligations that we have. And on reading this poem for the first time a number of years ago, she experienced such a sense of deep recognition that her own poetic written response was immediate. I mean, it was astonishing. I actually watched her write this response. And as I said, given that her formal education was interrupted early, What an indictment of our system that we have to find the potential of this young woman behind the wire. What an indictment of the system. A time to be caged and a time to be numb, her beauty and songs unheard of by some. A cry of joy or purely of pain. She'll wake up and sing again. No doubt of how her voice will be heard, whether she sings or shouts, she is still a caged bird. Sung with volumes as days pass her by, but how will she know what is beyond the sky? Is it to be happy while the caged bird sings, unaware of what her life may bring? Or is it a greater power that locks her cage, someone with fury or someone with rage? The joys of the songs of freedom and flying are caged in sorrow and belong in dying. Soft warmth of sun born in mists of rain, sung herself to sleep to try and hide her pain. Now I know why I sang and what pulled me through. I questioned the system, but they had not a clue. Because deep in my heart, it had a beat. The wind blew hard, but I got back on my feet. I can sing through the pain and all that they dealt. I would have rather be caged than to have never have felt. Then the cage grew old and fell apart. It gave me a journey of heart. Kia ora tātou.
If you've enjoyed Let's Talk this morning, you can listen to the repeat later on today via 989fm.com.au. Follow the links towards the links to the podcast, the Let's Talk, and then listen away. You can also listen to yesterday's program, part one, and also any other Let's Talks that we have had over the, forever, pretty much, all on the internet there. I hope you've enjoyed the program and you've been listening to Let's Talk here on 98.9 FM.